But if the forest is sick and is contaminated, then we're going to start to get sick, and we are going to disconnect ourselves from our knowledge, our language, and we are going to lose everything, as has happened to other peoples who have been disappearing for 500 years. And we do not want our territory and our life to disappear. We want to continue being Warani with a knowledge of two worlds, valuing our principles.
Namante Nankimo, an indigenous leader from the Warani Nation in the Amazon rainforest in Ecuador. Her new book is titled We Will Be Jaguars, A Memoir of My People. She wrote it with her partner, Mitch Anderson. Together, they founded the group Amazon Frontlines. And that does it for this holiday special. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermin Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Maddie Ali, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO's 2024 Catalog of Connections is hot off the presses. To get your copy featuring your favorite programs, letters from the board, and so much more, contact our membership director by calling 971-801-1381. That's 971-801-1381 or by emailing membership@kboo.org. We can't wait to connect with you.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
Making contact.
Welcome to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamarani, and today we're talking about Puerto Rico's failing healthcare system. And to start us off, we're in Fajardo, a small town on the island's northeast coast, about 40 minutes outside of San Juan, with someone named Carolina.
I grew up in Florida with family here in Puerto Rico, and I moved to the island permanently about 7 years ago, right before Hurricane Maria.
Carolina is not her real name, but for today's episode, we're giving our guests pseudonyms for medical privacy. And I wanted to talk to Carolina because her story is emblematic of the kinds of problems people in Puerto Rico face when dealing with serious health issues. She already had some idea about what the medical system was like on the island.
I had heard kind of anecdotally that, you know, the family that lived here or family that spent a lot of time here did not always find the doctors that they needed here. And so I was aware of people kind of traveling to other places in order to get the healthcare that they need.
Catalina wasn't thinking about her health when she first moved, though.
I had always wanted to connect more with the family that lived here, connect more with my culture. And specifically, I have for many years worked in the agroecology space. I wanted to move here and be a part of that and support organizing and community efforts for food justice and food sovereignty on the island.
But then something started to happen to her heart. One day, after a period of high stress in her life, she noticed that her heart was beating very irregularly, what's called an arrhythmia. And it wasn't a slight arrhythmia, it felt pretty serious.
I actually went to the emergency room because in the moment, I thought I was having a heart attack. And I went to the emergency room. I was checked out. The arrhythmia was noted. And, you know, I was sent away with basically the recommendation to follow up with a cardiologist because they did see on the EKG that, you know, something was not right.
But there aren't that many cardiologists in Puerto Rico for a population of 3.2 million. So she was told she'd have to wait.
The next appointment that I could get into was in 6 months. And I didn't feel comfortable with that. I was nervous. I was freaked out. I was like, what's going on, you know, with my heart?
Luckily, Carolina had a family member who worked in the medical field. And so through the cousin network, she was able to push to find an earlier appointment, which still took some time. Then she needed to get a specialized scan, which is when she hit yet another roadblock.
The electrophysiologist did determine that I needed to do a procedure. I needed to have done a procedure called an ablation, a cardiac ablation. And so in order to do that procedure, I had to have a number of different tests, blood work, echocardiogram, and also a very specific type of cardiac MRI in order to make sure that the structure of my heart was, you know, sound before going in and doing this procedure. But when I went to make the appointment, I learned that there's only two machines on the island that are capable of doing this particular type of MRI. One of which I was told was broken, and the other machine I called and again was told that there was a month-long wait. And my electrophysiologist's office specifically told me, you can't wait 3 or 4 or 5 months in order to get this procedure. And so they instructed me to call the office of this MRI every day and see if I could get an earlier appointment. And that's basically what I did for weeks on end. And I would step outside of my work meetings to get on the phone with this office and basically beg for them to give me this MRI appointment earlier.
She did eventually get a cardiac MRI and the procedure, but from finding out that she had a serious heart issue to finally getting the surgery took 6 months. And that's for a serious health condition.
I mean, if I had not at every single step of the way been pushing and calling and annoying the offices and begging and using my connections, it probably would have taken a year or more.
And now, because of her heart condition, she'll need to interact with the medical system in Puerto Rico a lot.
I will need to see a cardiologist and potentially be on medication for the rest of my life. And I have to constantly interface with the healthcare system, the pharmacies, my doctors, specialists. It is kind of an ongoing source of frustration and stress. And I do constantly have people asking me, well, isn't it hard to live there? I mean, the medical system, the bureaucracy, all sorts of interconnecting systems that really make life, like day-to-day life here, sometimes somewhat unbearable. I know that certain aspects of my life, especially managing chronic conditions, would be a lot easier in the States. But I want to stay here.
Catalina's story is in no way unique. Experts have been sounding the alarm on Puerto Rico since Hurricane Maria decimated what was already a fragile and vastly underfunded medical system. They've been arguing that it's on the verge of failure unless the island is able to massively overhaul its healthcare system.
And now to a growing problem in America's backyard. Puerto Rico is in the midst of a healthcare crisis after a series of natural disasters hit its rapidly aging population. The Washington Post's Aurelis Hernandez writes, more people are dying in Puerto Rico as its healthcare system crumbles.
And meanwhile, doctors are fleeing the island.
One study by a think tank in Puerto Rico called the Center for a New Economy, they estimated in 2023 that the island may have lost nearly half of its doctors in just over a decade. And they also reported that more than 8,000 doctors are thought to have left since 2009.
That's the voice of Coral Delmar Murphy Marcos. Coral is a journalist from Manatee who wrote an article for The Nation on the island's healthcare system called Puerto Rico's Unnatural Disaster. To put this another way, the island is now left with only one doctor for every 1,000 patients, which means that if you want to go see a doctor in Puerto Rico, get ready to wait.
People cannot get a doctor's appointment, and especially with if it requires a specialty treatment, say a cardiologist, a gynecologist, even a dentist, really.
Those wait times are not just an inconvenience. In 2022, researchers found that there was an excess of 3,300 deaths on the island. And that's after correcting for the ongoing impact of COVID, which means that Puerto Rico's failing healthcare system is actively killing people. Coral wanted to understand what was going on, especially because many of her peers who she'd studied with in the University of Puerto Rico, who wanted to be nurses or doctors, were struggling.
They would be raised with the idea that becoming a doctor would leave them with some sort of financial security, and going into the healthcare system, they quickly realized that that's not the case. And while doing reporting, I realized that specifically pediatricians are the doctors that are most feeling the weight of this healthcare crisis. And I wanted to dig deeper into seeing how pediatricians are affected.
And here's what she uncovered. Coral found that one of the biggest incentives for doctors to leave Puerto Rico was the extremely low reimbursement rates from healthcare insurers.
Reimbursements are what doctors get paid after seeing every patient. So after each patient, they essentially file a document to the health insurance company, and that's how they get paid, right? And not only do they face low rates, but doctors also cite payment delays as a pesky day-to-day challenge. And sometimes these delays can last for months.
And that might seem surprising because doctors are some of the highest paid professionals in the United States. But that's not the case in Puerto Rico, even though technically it's considered a part of the U.S.
Sometimes a doctor in the States could get paid double what a doctor in Puerto Rico is paid. I spoke to one doctor, for example, in Puerto Rico, that after every new patient visit, he gets $25 to $38, right, per patient, which is vastly different than in the U.S., where he could receive more than $100 for every new patient.
And we have to add to this the fact that doctors have massive student loans. Medical school can cost anywhere from $150,000 to $250,000. And because they run private clinics, doctors also have to pay staff, pay rent, pay for equipment, and malpractice insurance. As a low average, that all adds up to a little over $420,000 per year.
And chronic power outages also seem to be adding fuel to the fire. These power disruptions not only affect doctors, but people with health conditions that rely on power. Say someone with diabetes that need refrigeration for their insulin. As we're recording this, actually, my family doesn't have power a day before a tropical storm is supposed to hit the island. So that just sort of speaks to how frequent these power outages are.
So we know that doctors fleeing are at the basis of why healthcare is so dismal in Puerto Rico. But why are doctors paid so little? Well, there's basically two reasons. First, we need to understand a little bit more about the structure of the island's healthcare system, which was a little confusing for me to understand. Puerto Rico has Medicaid, like the U.S., which is run through the government's healthcare plan called Vital. Like in the U.S., Medicaid is meant to insure low-income people who would not be able to buy insurance on their own. And here's where it gets confusing.
Although it's a public program, it's run by four major private health insurance companies. They're First Medical, MMM, Menonita, and Triple S.
These companies are hired by the government to set up competitive rates, figure out what doctors are in network or not, and deny or approve treatment. And here's where we find the first problem. The private companies running the public healthcare plan are corrupt.
They have been labeled a health cartel. For example, in 2023, all four of these companies that I mentioned faced fines that totaled up to $300 million. Because they failed to pay doctors the minimum rates established for their services in the first half of the year. And even before that, in 2019, the former executive director of Puerto Rico's Health Insurance Administration, she was indicted after a scheme to steal federal Medicaid dollars through a corrupt bidding process with private contractors. So the system is really no stranger to corruption.
And that's just part of the problem, which is already pretty serious. The second issue, Puerto Rico doesn't receive the same level of funding for its healthcare system as the other official 50 states. And actually, this is true of all U.S. territories like Guam and Samoa. Even though Puerto Ricans pay the same in Social Security and Medicare taxes, they only receive about a third of the funding per person compared to the rest of the states, even though far more people depend on the government healthcare plan.
This imbalance is really, really noticeable, especially in a territory where over 40% of the population lives under the poverty line.
For comparison, 19% of the population of Mississippi, which is the poorest state in the U.S., lives under the poverty line. In fact, the federal government of the U.S. usually gives the poorest states more Medicaid assistance because clearly they need it more. But not in Puerto Rico. And within that dismal funding setup, children are the most at risk. So there are two tiers of money available. Medicare is for people over 65, and it's usually given priority. And Medicaid is for low-income families.
Medicare pays a lot more than Medicaid. So sometimes doctors, say a cardiologist, will rely mostly and will give priority to people with Medicare. But pediatricians don't have that luxury. Pediatricians can only rely on Medicaid, and it pays a lot less. I even interviewed one who moved to Phoenix, and I spoke to him and asked him some of the reasons why he left. And he cited some of the same reasons we were talking about before: payment delays, low reimbursement rates. It just wasn't worth it. It's just not feasible being a pediatrician. And he just got a one-way ticket and left. He said in Phoenix, in the hospital he currently works in, he doesn't face these payment delays. He's not planning to go back, sadly.
There's currently only one pediatric heart surgeon left on the entire island. And it's not just the migration of its medical staff. Puerto Rico also doesn't have medical equipment. It often doesn't have electricity. And the smaller island Vieques, which is part of Puerto Rico, doesn't even have a hospital. Its one partially functioning hospital was destroyed in 2017 during Hurricane Maria. But it wasn't always this way. Once Puerto Rico's almost entirely public healthcare system was a model for the rest of the Caribbean. And the reasons that it's changed and why it's not so easy to go back means that we have to talk about the big elephant in the room: Puerto Rico's status as a U.S. colony. Stay tuned. We'll be getting a history lesson right after the break.
I'm jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. Okay, now back to the show.
Welcome back to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamrani. Today, we're talking about Puerto Rico's failing healthcare system.
Between shortages in medical professional, lack or losing power very often, you know, all of these things that come into play both in regular life in Puerto Rico, but then just become aggravated when it has to do with healthcare. That's a concern.
That's Paula. Again, not her real name. Paula left Puerto Rico for grad school about 7 years ago, and she wanted to share her reasons for why she decided not to go home, which is basically that she cannot rely on the medical system.
I have IBD, ulcerative colitis. When I left, it definitely wasn't a reason why I left. I didn't see myself as chronically ill, and I think I was kind of just freshly diagnosed and not knowing what this meant for the rest of my life, really. It takes time to understand that. Basically, it tends to either stay the same or get worse over time, and so I had a few years where it did definitely get worse. That means that I now have to get more invasive and intense medications to just have some quality of life. So the medication that I'm on is an immunosuppressant, and it's given by IV infusion. So that means that I have to visit an infusion room in the hospital every so many weeks to get that medication. But I would say that on average throughout the year, I would see between infusions and doctors, I'll see a medical professional a couple times a month. And I don't know if I would be able to do that back home because there is just such a shortage of medical staff.
After Paula left Puerto Rico, her condition got progressively worse. So when the time came to decide what was next for her and her husband, they realized that healthcare had become a huge deciding factor.
My husband is also from Puerto Rico, and I don't think that neither of us, but probably especially him, ever thought we would not be back on the island for the long term, the rest of our lives, basically. So coming to terms with that was really hard, coming to terms with putting down roots in the U.S. was very strange and very conflicting. And I think even now it's been, we moved here like 7 years ago. And even now, once a month, we'll have a crisis of, should we be here? Should we go back? What are we doing? So this is still an ongoing dilemma in our hearts and in our minds. Even now that we rethink all the time how much we would want to be back home on the island, every time we try to think about all the considerations, all the concerns that we have about going back, we kind of find a solution for all of them except this, right? The healthcare that I need.
Will there ever be a way that someone like Paula can return to Puerto Rico with a serious health condition? Well, that depends. Fixing Puerto Rico's healthcare system means grappling with the island's colonial history.
For over a century, Puerto Rico has been under U.S. control. This colonial relationship has deeply influenced the island's public health system.
That's the voice of Coral Del Murphy Marcos, the reporter you heard from in the beginning of the show.
In the early 20th century, healthcare was rudimentary. So the focus was primarily on combating tropical diseases like malaria and TB with limited resources and infrastructure.
For most of its history, Puerto Rico was ignored by the U.S. But then Cuba had a revolution, and Kennedy and the then governor of Puerto Rico, Luis Muñoz Marin, decided to develop Puerto Rico, create a wealthier capitalist country with a strong middle class in order to ward off the spread of communism. They called this plan Operation Bootstrap.
As the island industrialized, the healthcare system saw some improvements in the 1960s. Hospitals were built and more medical professionals were trained, and a lot of them were government workers. So it was truly a public healthcare system.
Despite being a colonial capitalist country, Puerto Rico basically had a socialist medical system. Doctors were paid by the government, and 63% of all healthcare facilities were government-run. Two-thirds of the population had free healthcare. But it didn't stay that way.
Fast forward to the 1990s, when the then-governor, Pedro Rosselló, introduced La Reforma, which is a healthcare overhaul that basically privatized nearly every public hospital and clinic in Puerto Rico. So a lot of these doctors, instead of being public workers, were now under private entities. So La Reforma was pitched as a way to boost doctors' wages and incentivize them, but it's 2024 and the opposite has happened.
That's why in Puerto Rico, at least on the left, there's been a call to reverse parts of La Reforma in order to recreate a universal healthcare system all across the island. But there's one huge barrier, and it has to do with Puerto Rico's political status and its colonial debt.
So technically, legally speaking, it is a commonwealth, but a lot of people are starting to question exactly what this means and whether we should just call Puerto Rico plain and simply a colony.
So why has that narrative shifted, and what does it have to do with the collapsing medical system in Puerto Rico? To end the show, we sat down with Alberto Medina from Boricuas Unidos en la Diaspora to talk about Puerto Rico's debt.
The debt and the fact that the debt restructuring process is in the controls of the fiscal control board in Puerto Rico, appointed by Congress, is a huge impediment, because the fiscal control board has basically instituted a massive austerity program in Puerto Rico, including cuts to the healthcare system that in many ways, many of us believe have made the crisis worse.
Similar to many former or current colonies, Puerto Rico has a massive unpayable debt, which arose from a combination of local financial mishandling and laws in the U.S., which made the island a tax haven in many different forms since it became a U.S. territory. In 2016, Puerto Rico defaulted on the debt. It owes about $71 billion, which is almost 70% of its GDP.
It was considered the biggest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history, if we consider Puerto Rico part of the U.S., which is, of course, a different discussion.
Puerto Rico was unable to declare bankruptcy on its own because of a law passed by Congress that stipulates that territories or colonies basically just can't do that. So the management of the debt went straight to the federal government of the United States. Congress created a debt restructuring process called PROMESA, which would ensure that Puerto Rico repaid the money it owed to the various vulture funds who had basically invested in the debt. And in order to do this, in 2016, they created something called the Fiscal Control Board,
which is a body of unelected bureaucrats appointed by the President of the United States based on recommendations from the U.S. Congress, that is basically completely in charge of Puerto Rico's finances, not just the debt restructuring process, but, you know, they get to approve the budgets. They can veto, you know, Puerto Rican laws if they determine that the laws don't comply with the board's fiscal plans for Puerto Rico. That can override the actions of Puerto Rico's legislature, of Puerto Rico's governor. So it's a big impediment to any meaningful action and improvements.
The Fiscal Control Board is an extremely controversial theme in Puerto Rico, where it's often referred to as La Junta.
It is basically in charge of the island's finances, which in many ways makes it in charge of the entire island, because the government is what you can pay for and what you budget for, and the board is in charge of all of that.
In order to force Puerto Rico to pay its debt, the Fiscal Control Board has implemented extreme austerity measures across the island. Not only is the healthcare system failing, but the educational system is also on the verge of collapse because of massive cuts to salaries, pensions, and schools. This means that Puerto Rico is limited in its choices about how to tackle its healthcare system or any public service. But Alberto argues, as would many Puerto Ricans, that they can't just let the U.S. control their sovereignty.
There are proposals from various parties and movements in Puerto Rico to have a universal healthcare system. There's many other, you know, proposals to, for example, try to bring doctors back from the U.S. and reverse some of that exodus of medical professionals. There's been legislation proposed, for example, to rein in the power of the insurance companies that have also played a role in the deterioration of the healthcare system. You know, as with many things in politics, we need to push and we need to try. And if the board gets in our way, then we need to try to remove the board.
This is completely possible. There are several ways to fight Puerto Rico's debt crisis. One, ending the Fiscal Control Board, which has never had a clear timeline for its existence.
The Fiscal Control Board was created by an act of Congress, and another act of Congress could eliminate it. You know, the Democratic Party actually, to its partial credit, put the elimination of the Fiscal Control Board in its party platform at the most recent convention. Now, I have my doubts that they're actually planning to follow through with that, but I think it at least shows that there is some level of understanding that the board hasn't worked, that it's undemocratic, that it's bad for Puerto Ricans.
The other fix? Examining what's in the debt itself, which oddly wasn't part of the restructuring plan by Congress.
One of the things that many, many organizations in Puerto Rico have called for is for the debt to be audited, because there is a widespread belief that some of this debt, or much of it actually, was issued illegally. Congress could have very well written it that the debt should be audited before the process. They did not do that. The board has completely refused to audit the debt. So there could very well be, you know, billions of dollars in illegal debt that Puerto Rico may not, you know, have to be on the hook for.
Taken together, these measures could return economic sovereignty to Puerto Rico and allow it to start fixing some of its crumbling public infrastructure. The debt is an especially brutal form of colonialism, and it's why so many of the younger generation, like Coral's peers, have opted to call Puerto Rico a colony instead of a territory or a commonwealth. Some people are even calling for outright independence from the U.S. That's a topic that's controversial on the island, but it's one that many younger Puerto Ricans are starting to embrace.
I and my organization and organizations like ours believe the long-term solution is to address the status issue. And, you know, in our case, what we believe in and push for is for Puerto Rico's independence. You know, as a colony, Puerto Rico has not had the tools of strong, sustainable economic development. Puerto Rico cannot do its own trade deals, cannot set duties and tariffs, you know, cannot control its fiscal policy. It does not have the good tools of economic development. So it has had to rely on really bad tools like issuing massive amounts of debt to try to survive. After 126 years of Puerto Rico being a colony of the United States, that is the real deep solution to all of Puerto Rico's problems that doesn't just address the symptoms, but the actual disease.
And that does it for today's show. This is actually a story we'll be keeping an eye on from Puerto Rico. And there's a lot at stake, actually, in this year's elections on the island. There are candidates pushing for universal healthcare and independence from the U.S., but there are also conservative candidates who are pushing for a heightened connection to the U.S. If you'd like to know more, visit us online, focmedia.org, or visit us on social media to stay up to date on this story, the debt, and the elections in Puerto Rico. I'm Salima Hamrani, and thanks for listening to Making Contact.